Yeah, so maybe that's the question for Serious Runner. Like, for all the posturing that you're doing on Strava and social media to make yourself look like this great, big, important runner, like, how is running benefiting you in your life, and how are you using it in a positive way for yourself or for others?
So you're just listening to a snippet of a conversation with Stephen Ganoza. Before releasing this podcast, I was kind of in two minds of whether to release a best of the 100 episodes and the lessons that I learned. But to be honest, like, it's just, life is too serious right now. So I thought, let's just go for something a little bit lighthearted, a little bit of comic relief. So I really want to shine a light on Stephen and his character of the Serious Runner. Now, I came across his work on YouTube, and after watching a couple of the videos, you sort of think, ah, you know, that's actually reflecting a light back to myself. And that's what all great comedy does. It reflects the truth back to us. And I think actually on a deeper level, it kind of makes us ask some deeper questions, which we go into. So this conversation is kind of a mixture between kind of lightheartedness, but also really asking ourselves some serious questions that I think we need to really think about as runners. And in that massive ramble, I completely forgot to introduce my own podcast. So welcome to, or welcome back to, A Runner's Life podcast. As always, I want to thank and shout out the patrons that support the show. I've got some really cool things coming up in terms of trying to take the podcast outside of recording studio, aka my house, and move it into something live, something a bit more exciting, something you can see actually. That sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? It seems like I'm going to record in my house, but rest assured it's not going to be that, because that's just boring. That's MTV Cribs, and unfortunately I don't live that kind of extravagant lifestyle. Anyhow, what I'm planning to do is take the podcast out live, get some cool recordings. Like, you might have seen some of the stuff we did recently, you know, recording at the Maverick Race. We've got some cool things coming up with the London Marathon, so stay tuned for that. I also want to shout out the supporters of the show, Tracksmith. Thank you for your continuous support, not just supporting the work that I'm doing, but also supporting the work in the wider running community and just highlighting and showing a light on the areas that we don't always get to see and appreciate, and just make us think a little bit more about the running culture and make people that who don't see themselves as runners or who haven't tried running feel that this is actually a space for them and it's not some sort of weird click type thing, because it's not. Literally, you just go outside, you move your feet, you're a runner. I mean, there's no club to join, so I think that's the cool thing about it. And one, actually, my favorite bits of kit that I've been wearing on the runs and even just casually is the new track and field cap. I think it might be sold out, I'm not quite sure if it's coming back again, but I really love this, the way that it's really simple, navy blue. And Elliot, the Tracksmith hair, makes an appearance in different colors. Before we jump into the conversation, I want to share something that happened on a run recently. I've had some really random experiences with members of the public last week running. I was doing my interval sessions and I was approaching this gentleman and he literally just coughed. It was kind of like a mixture between a cough and just screaming at me, but he literally did it as I ran past him. And you just, like, I turned around to him, I went, really? Like, what is that? Like, who does that? But I think he sneezed or coughed or whatever, and he apologized as I came round on the next lap. But I'm not going to lie, I mean, it did kind of unsettle me quite a bit, because you're thinking, why? You're just thinking, why, basically. But, you know, you kind of get back into your stride and you just get back into it. So then earlier in the week, I was doing an easy run and I had this guy who saw me as some sort of competition and just started doing some absolute madness. He was doing some sprinting, backwards sprinting, whilst throwing shadow punches, doing star jumps. Did it for about a quarter of a mile, and he's expecting me to kind of rise to it and just try to kind of match him. But I'm like, dude, I'm doing my easy run. You do you, I do me. I actually thought it was quite funny, and I also thought, on one hand, I was like, is this guy pranking me? Because this is so ridiculous, it's so out of character. So he does all this madness for about a quarter of a mile. He gets into the road, starts doing like press ups, burpees, obviously for show. And as soon as I pass him, I turn around to have a look. This man's just like puffing and puffing, he's out of breath. So you're just like, man, just don't try to copy other people, don't try to impress other people, just do you, stay in your lane, because like, That's just ridiculous, man. You just got to enjoy it. But yeah, two random experiences this week, and it's just been one of those weeks where you're just kind of just getting through it, just making sure you're just staying consistent, and I just continue as a build towards the London Marathon. So for the people that are listening to this, I hope that your running is going well. I know it's a tough moment right now, and it's been a tough moment for quite a while for so many people, so I think just embrace where we are and just try to make the best of each day and just try to focus what we can be grateful on. And on that Jerry Springer note, you know, it's pretty poor, I know. Let's head to the conversation. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to A Runner's Life podcast. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, Marcus.
No worries. Before we get into the conversation, can you start off by telling us what A Runner's Life means to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it means a lot of different things to different people. You know, I think for me personally, A Runner's Life, it's about community building. So it's sort of like external and internal, right? There's an aspect of it that I use running to make friends and build community. And those are the people I hang out with. And an internal aspect of it that's like stress relief, right? Like yeah. It's kind of meditative and what I do to unwind and run away from my computer and all my screens and work and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we spoke a little bit offline about some of the stuff that you're doing with trail events. And I've had a conversation separately with a race director for another recording I did. And he was talking about the idea that, say, the road runners run for the love of the sport, but trail runners run for the love of running. I mean, what do you sort of think about that? And does that sort of tie into your sort of idea of what running looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that is probably because road running, marathon and shorter, is much more defined, right? Like there are very clear benchmarks in terms of qualifying for Boston or qualifying for the Olympic trials. And the distances are very, like they're measured distances, right? So you know your time across a certain mileage is a certain effort. Whereas in trail running, like that doesn't really exist. So trail running has its marquee events like UTMB or Western States, but short of the top elites, you're getting in through lottery, right? So I think that often for many people who aren't, you know, the top elites, the distance is the challenge. And you know, as you know, those of us who've done trail races know the distances in a trail race are an approximation, right? Like a 100-mile course might be 98 miles. It might be 104 miles. Who knows? You can't roll a wheel over the trail to measure it, right? So I think maybe it's the precision a little bit and the structure of, you know, how you excel in the sports are different. And that's what you know, creates the little bit of difference there.
And also some courses rely on you for like navigation, or, you know, someone, you know, might have thought that the signs were like rubbish or whatever, so they move the signs and then you can end up getting lost and coming back. So trail races could be a lot longer potentially.
Yeah, well, sometimes your own fault. Yeah, I love trail races that are like so well marked. I did the Vermont 100 and it was my favorite because they put up yellow plates, like dinner plates. Yeah. I swear, like every 10th of a mile, like I never felt lost and it was great. And I get lost easily. And I'm sure you've gotten this too. Everybody sees the Barclays documentary on Netflix and they're like, oh, do you want to run Barclays? Like, no, like I'd get lost and I'd never make it out of the woods alive.
I know, I'd probably be that guy that'd be doing like a less than a mile loop, just going round and round and just going mad. So it looks hard and I'm sure doing it is even harder.
Yeah. I mean, I started in road running. I'm getting into trail running now, but there's definitely enough road runners still in me that like, I want to know where I am. And the idea of orienteering, like not quite something I'm up for quite yet.
Exactly. It's another level of another skill to add on to the pain of running. So yeah.
Yeah.
But we say the pain of running, but I mean, there are more painful things that you can be doing. So I came across your content on YouTube. And the thing I like about it is I think it's just like all good comedy, I think, is rooted in truth. And what I like about the Serious Runner character is it highlights some of the things that we take quite seriously, and it holds a mirror back to ourselves. And before I go on, I mean, full disclaimer to the listeners and anyone listening, that I'm not having a pop at you or anyone else or judging, because a lot of the things I see in the episodes, I can actually see myself doing. So this is less judgment than anyone else, but more just going, yep, I do that. Like, for example, something you said about on Strava, where I do this like every week, is where you do your warm up, but then you stop your warm up and then you do your tempo run separately, because you don't want your tempo miles to be diluted by the warm up or the cool down miles. I do that every week. So,
yeah, I mean, it's true though. When people are scrolling through their feed, you want them to see like, oh, 6 minute miles. Like, you don't want them to see 8 minute miles.
Yeah.
And are they really going to dig in and look at your splits to know that?
Yeah.
These are real concerns.
Yeah, these are real concerns. I mean, like, for me, I like to have a clear difference just by and by.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's important too. Like the idea that like we all do these things. And I think that's what's, and I do a lot of them too. I mean, a lot of the material that I use for Serious Runner videos are things that I do personally, or things that like my friends do, right? And you know, I've tried to be very careful about not making fun of people for doing certain things, but more like making fun of how people react to certain things.
Yeah.
Right. Like I don't necessarily want to, well, not necessarily, I don't want to make fun of somebody for running slow. Right.
Yeah.
But I could make fun of how somebody like reacts to seeing somebody running slow.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's where the humor lives, and you know, kind of like maybe saying out loud some things that we're all thinking but don't say.
Yeah, but the thing is though, I don't think some people are even aware that these things are going on, and they're just doing it. Like, there's the whole Boston topic, which I want to get onto, but before we get there, I just want to take a step back. And I know you spoke about some of the things that you do, some of your friends do, but what was the kind of moment it clicked for you when, Serious Runner, the characters formed from seeing this or seeing these points?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the idea evolved from an effort to make a failed documentary a couple years ago. Yes, it's kind of a roundabout way to get to Serious Runner, but I had been intrigued by the ambassador programs by many brands, right? Where, you know, they'd give you some free product and you'd go on Instagram and promote it for free and you know, whatever. So I wanted to explore, you know, like what was that business model, who really benefits from it, and things like that. And generally, what impact is social media having on running? Not surprisingly, I couldn't get any of the brands to go on camera for the documentary. So the project fell apart, and this was about 3 years ago. But this interesting dynamic always persisted in my head, because I'd see people essentially just gramming about products they liked and almost using it to, you know, get, you know, to show like, oh, you know, I love running so much that I'm investing in this or that, right? And Instagram in particular, aside from the product stuff, the way that people use filters and frame their photos and stage things, it was just all really interesting to me. And it became a game, especially, so I live in Colorado now, but I moved here 2 years ago from New York City.
Yeah.
And the New York City road running scene is incredible. Like, it is probably like the best in the world. The New York Roadrunner ecosystem is amazing. All the clubs, teams, like you can always find dozens of people in your pace group to run with, right?
Yeah.
But it kind of bred like competition, not only in terms of how fast you were, but like how much of an influencer you were on social media, right? Like, did you have to buy your Goose, or was Goose sending it to you for free? And so, you know, all this sort of led to this character that, you know, is more or less based on combining different things that I had seen from really serious roadrunners in and around New York City, right? And just kind of observing the way people posted on Strava, the way people posted on Instagram, you know, what seemed important to them? What were their behaviors? What were their mentalities? And, you know, and how does everybody approach Boston, right?
Yeah, the Boston one is I want to jump into, but like, I want to save that. But I think what you said there is really interesting in terms of just like how people obviously still love the sport, but then have that external thing influence them. And I think, you know, looking at the character, it does sort of highlight the fact that some runners, not all runners, I'm not judging all runners, can put a lot of focus on external things, shoes, kit, nutrition, race prestige, whatever. I mean, how do you think people can probably look at the character or just even look at themselves and be like, take themselves a little less seriously? Well, things that don't matter as much, less seriously, but still focus on the running.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is that people tend to identify themselves by their running, right? Yeah. And this is not just specific to running, right? Like, this is could be if you've worked in a job for a long time and then you get laid off, right? That's like you kind of an identity crisis, right? Or this is, it seems overly dramatic to equate it to veterans coming home, right? But like, if you're not fighting in a war anymore, like, what's your identity?
Yeah.
And I think that social media has, you know, people who are really into running, it's given them a way to like define themselves and identify themselves as runners, like first and foremost, right? So yeah, so it's really interesting then when you sort of turn a mirror on themselves, right? And sort of highlight, well, you know, people want to identify as a runner and define themselves by their running, but, you know, in an ironic sort of way, they're doing many of the same things that all the other runners are doing, right? So it's like not so much building, you know, your personal brand or your personal identity, but it's this sort of weird, like, well, this is what runners do, so this is what I have to do. And I think when you take a step back and look at that, that's where some of these like hilarities come out, right? That like, oh, you know, like, yes, whenever there's a headwind, we always like blame our paces on the headwind.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But if we get a tailwind, we don't talk about that.
No, absolutely not. Or, you know, like I will always, you know, post so much of my running success on Instagram, but never like really a failure, right?
Yeah.
Because like I'm building this identity as a runner, and it's part of the larger problem of social media, right? Like curating our lives to present them in a particular way.
Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, even when you talk about races, like sometimes how people can build up races, and I did this recently. I was going to do a half marathon and I was going to use it as like a marathon tempo workout, and I ended up doing the second COVID jab and it just wiped me out. But I remember when I wrote the post back, I was like, oh well, I treated it like a marathon training run. He said something similar to that. I'm just like, oh my god, I'm gonna sound like such an idiot now, because the way he written it, like, well, people go for races, but you know, I had to scale it back and be like, well, I'm only doing this run. I was like, oh damn.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you get into this place where it's like, oh, I've got to look better than the next person, right? And sometimes like you don't realize that you're doing it, you know. You'll post on Strava like, oh, this was a terrible run. I felt so slow, felt so sluggish, right? And maybe, yeah, like, and either you're lying or like you really did feel bad and you ran an 8:30, but you know what? 8:30 is somebody's 5K time, right? And somebody's really proud of racing at an 8:30 pace.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you kind of lose sight of that sometimes because you're just trying to like, you know, think about how you look always, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's a good way. It's sort of showing us to kind of just reflect on probably why we're doing these things, because it's so easy. Like you said, when you start off running, it's something you enjoy, but then you start following other people's behaviors and habits, taking them on as your own, not really realizing that you're kind of falling within that kind of pattern, almost away from running.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, it's like somewhere somehow society has like defined these are the things you do if like you're a serious runner, right? And you know, whether consciously or subconsciously, like if you see that all the time on social media, you kind of move towards those habits.
Yeah. And I think one thing that is, not that it didn't have any credibility before, but I think one thing that's added an extra layer of just like credibility to the videos that you've done is the feature of Sage the day. Yeah. And like anyone knows like what he's done in the sport. And I think there's one particular sketch, I don't want to give it away, but like when you sort of said to him about his Boston Marathon placing, he went, "Only that placing, I literally died." But that's what people do in social media. They're like, oh, they're criticizing people who are just like so much like head and shoulders above them for the weight, the way they look, the speed. And it's like, hold on a second, this is just ridiculous.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, go on the Let's Run message boards. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And I know it myself because I remember when I, one of my goals was to break sub three. And I remember I joined this group of death, basically, in Facebook, of all these guys with lots of egos telling us how good they were and how people who weren't in sub three shouldn't be in that group. And I was just like, and I remember getting kicked out of this group because I said something. And I was just like, do you know what? I'm going to prove you guys wrong. And eventually did. So it's quite nice. So I'm always aware of just not being that guy, of being like, oh, I'm this, I'm that. Because you're like, look, just be respectful, because unless you're like Eliud Kipchoge, then I guess everyone's slow. So
yeah, right. If you're not first, you're last. But yeah, but you know what's really interesting living in a place like Boulder, Colorado, is that I've gotten to know so many really fast runners, right? And pros like Sage or Claire Gallagher. And you know, what's really interesting is that they are so humble and so nice and so accessible. And, you know, it almost feels like the people who are at the elite level and the pro level, you know, don't feel threatened. Whereas, like, if I run a 3-hour marathon and you run a 2:45 marathon, like, you might be feel threatened by me that I might be faster than you one day, right?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why people take themselves too seriously, you know, because they're, you know, back to like identities and stuff. Like, I know I've seen this in the clubs in New York, you kind of develop a hierarchy based on how fast you are, right? Like all the fast guys go over there and like do their thing. And, you know, are you fast enough to hang out with them? But people like Sage are just like so far above and beyond better than we are. It's like, I don't think they play that game.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, like, do you know when you watch those like, old Kung Fu movies and it's just like a random village, but there's like, they're filled, it's like full of like Kung Fu masters, but you just don't know it. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, whoa, where did that speed come from? Do you know what I mean? But they don't need to be like, you know, this is what I do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's been great. I mean, Sage has been, for some reason, he really loves the videos and is always willing to show up for a little cameo.
I mean, how did you approach him to with the idea, and like, what was his initial thoughts when you suggested it to him?
I think his initial thoughts, if I remember correctly, I showed up and I had like the whole first video scripted out in standard screenplay format with like scene headings and dialogue and the whole nine. And I think he just like was like, oh, okay. And like a little overwhelmed by that. I tend to spend a lot of time and a lot of effort on organizing things more than they need to be, but he went along with it. And, you know, he has a small cameo in the first video actually, where somebody is criticizing him for being vegan, right? They're telling him that if, you know, he'd be fast if he ate a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
On Let's Run. You know, and it's just a small little scene. And he actually helped me a lot film that whole first video. And then, you know, when that first video really just kind of got a lot of positive reactions and we knew, you know, it was obvious that like there was something there, right? Like it was resonating. And now, you know, Sage's great. He'll you know, send me ideas for new videos and like help me with the scripts. So he's been a really good partner, you know, in subsequent videos.
Yeah, I think it definitely adds something to the video. And like I said, that Boston like line just definitely got me. And I think people just watch it. Yeah, just watch it and you'll know what I'm talking about. And I think that sort of nicely leads into the Boston element. And I'm almost got to be a bit mindful now I say this, because I think once you get the Boston qualifier, they do like people can become a bit blasé about it. So I'm mindful of not trying to be that guy when I ask you this question, because I'm going to fall into that serious runner trap. But there is a lot of focus on like the Boston Marathon, and like from the outsider looking in, like especially not American, so don't shoot me down for saying this, mm-hmm. listeners. Like I don't always fully get just the thing about why Boston is so like culturally revered within the States, and just runners even generally as like being the standard of, you know, what a runner is, or do you know what I mean, what a serious runner should be. I mean, what do you sort of think that comes from?
I honestly don't know. I just know that that's the way it's turned out, right? Like to me, the Boston Marathon is sort of like the US dollar, right? Like it's a worthless piece of paper, but we all like have decided it has value.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Boston is a great race, is great energy. I think that there are better marathons. The first half of the Boston Marathon is kind of lonely. You don't really get spectators until you get close to the city. But, you know, for whatever reason, it's become this standard that, like, you know, you're a real runner if you're good enough to get into Boston. And I don't know how that started. I don't know if it's just the idea that you can't sign up for it and it's not a lottery, right? Like that there is some sort of hurdle to get in. But like it's definitely a thing where it's like, you know, have you qualified for Boston? Have you run Boston? The jacket is a really good way of signaling to everybody that you've done Boston. So like, you know, you're a legitimate runner. You're not just jogging around, right?
Yeah.
But to be completely honest, I don't know like how that got started. It just is.
Yeah, it's so true though, because it does highlight the thing about this, the Boston jacket, the haloed Boston jacket, and who can wear it, and even things about like the virtual races, and even coming down to the actual race. I mean, I've seen conversations online where people are like, oh, how dare charity runners take part? It should be only for people who have qualified and have reached the lofty standards. And you're like, come on, like, this isn't just for like one type of person. This is where we're kind of splitting hairs, because like, if you look at something like the London Marathon, they've still got like Good for Rage place and championship places, and still like they're the biggest, one of the biggest charity fundraisers globally. So you can still have all those elements and not exclude different people from running.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that the perception around Boston is that like if you've run Boston, you're fast, right? So the charity runners are, and again, like I've done this in serious runner videos, I'm not personally saying the charity runner shouldn't be allowed to run, right? But the idea is that like, you know, if I worked hard for years to get my marathon time down low enough to get into Boston, why should this person be able to raise a couple thousand dollars and just like walk in? Like they're cheating or taking a shortcut or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. And also when you look at the times as well, like New York qualifying times are a lot harder to get into, I'd say, than Boston. But that never gets spoken about as much.
They are, but there's a lot of ways to get into New York City Marathon, right? I don't know if there's a lottery anymore, but there's the 9+1 program, right? Where you run a bunch of the NYRR races and volunteer, and that gets you in. If you're in one of the New York City running clubs, right, those teams often have spots that they can give away.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's definitely ways into it, but I think my point was more that, like, it's the aspect of the qualification. Like, no one talks about that qualification as much if we're talking about it on that aspect, whereas what with Boston, it's like the qualification becomes almost bigger than the race itself, bigger than the history.
Oh, absolutely. And I think this year they're even selling t-shirts like Boston qualifier.
Yeah.
Like it's not even, they're not even finisher shirts. They're just like qualifier shirts. Yeah, but Boston's really interesting. And I'm guilty of this as well. This is exactly my Boston experience. I worked harder to get into Boston than to run Boston, which, you know, leads to the interesting thing where when you start the Boston Marathon, everybody's misseated. Because like I ran a 2:55 to get in, and then I didn't really train for Boston that much. So I was like seated with people who were running sub three, but like that day I was, I don't know, I think it'd be like 3:05 or something, right? Just because like Boston wasn't the goal race. Boston was essentially the victory lap, right? The qualifying was the goal.
See, that sounds like something that the serious runner would say only.
Yeah, I should write that down for a future script.
Only 3:05. Saving myself for another race.
See, this is why I think that the videos work, though, because right there, like, I wasn't even thinking about it, and I said something really obnoxious, and, you know, yeah, if I saw a serious runner about video that said that, then I'd be like, oh, yeah, I have, like, just been, you know, tone deaf and said stuff like that.
Oh man, we are all guilty of it. It's just like that constant checking, isn't it, between like,
yeah.
And sort of separately, you were sort of talking about shoes as well, and I remember one episode you were talking about like you can't put a price on epicness, and and like it doesn't really matter if you're going to be whatever place out of your age group, you need to have those shoes. And the funny thing about shoes, and something I've been thinking about more recently, is like when you look at some of like the old school runners, like they didn't have all the nutrition stuff, they didn't have these fancy carbon plated shoes, but they still ran times that are still competitive today. I don't think the times are that much better up to a certain point. And I was speaking to a shoe brand as well, and they were sort of talking about the aspect that we forget that these shoes are designed for a certain type of person, weight, height, stride, and then it's sold to the rest of us as like this thing that's going to elevate us, but we kind of leave out that big sort of section of actually you're not the same size as an elite runner in terms of height, you know what I mean, like stride, all the other bits, so you're not really gonna have the same benefits.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I agree with that completely, and this is just from my personal experience. So I started running in like, so I was a later in life runner. Like I never ran at all in high school or college. Like I played video games. I was a film school kid. Like this stuff wasn't on, you know, my radar at all until years after college. But I first started to get serious about it in like 2016. So like a good year or two before the Vaporflies came out. And I was really fortunate. I joined a team in New York called the Dashing Whippets. And I got really lucky that there was a group of like six other people who joined at the same time who were all around my pace and were all looking to qualify for Boston, right? And so, you know, I saw a lot of people struggling to get under 3:05 because that was the cutoff then, right? Like it was like not easy to get down to 3:05. And then something happened. Those shoes came out and suddenly a lot of people were breaking 3 hours in the marathon. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, I can't give you hard data that says, like, they absolutely work. Anecdotally, things that I've observed, people were suddenly breaking three. And I think that's also evidenced by the lowering of the Boston qualifying times and how outrageous the cutoffs are beyond the BQ time now. I do think that if somebody's like a 4-hour marathoner, they're probably not going to help you that much, right? But I can say from personal experience that for people around the 3-hour mark, they definitely help take off a couple minutes.
I mean, like $700, £700 for that. I mean, it definitely counts. I'm not gonna lie.
It better do something.
I hope so. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think some of it does work, but then I think as well, there's a part of it that is the mental aspect of, oh, these are my race shoes, and you go into it believing that extra. You have that extra little bit of belief. Obviously, you still need to do the work. You can't just wish it into existence and do nothing and be like, once the alpha flies arrive, then I'll go.
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe they have some placebo effect there, yeah. You know, but I mean, I don't know how you could ever scientifically measure that, yeah. Right? But definitely the perception is that, like, if I want to be on an even playing field with other people and, like, if I'm worried about getting into Boston, I better buy those shoes because everybody else who's trying to get into Boston is going to be wearing them.
Yeah, yeah, true. But like I said, when I look at some of sort of the runners in yesteryear, still doing some amazing times. But then you've got to bear in mind as well that I think less people were running and I think people were at a higher level that were competing. So it's hard to sort of compare today's numbers against yesteryear's numbers because I think more people take part across a wider spectrum of paces.
Yeah, and you said this before, like the only thing that, like the shoes aren't the only thing that changed, yeah. Right? Like nutrition has changed incredibly, right? Just, I think we just know more about how to train and, you know, I don't know if how accurate anything like all these wearables are, right? But like maybe it's just people paying more attention. The recovery products, right? Yeah. Like the massage guns and things like this, right? So like you can't just say like the shoes are the only variable that's changed and therefore like that's the only difference that's been made.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm trying not to sound like a super fan and I'm not going to say the line what you said about the massage guns. People need to watch it. I won't give it away. But when you said it, it made me think of it initially.
Yeah. But what's interesting though is that sometimes in my head, I think about my marathon PR in the pre-carbon plate days, you know, like quote unquote real marathon PR is a 3:01 because that's the fastest I ran before the shoes came
along. It might be funny, but that is like an episode for Serious Runner, like pre-carbon and like post. Oh, like seriously, because it'd be like, well, you can imagine all the old school runners would be like, well, you know, you guys are kind of cheating, you should have done it this way, and just looking down at us. So yeah
exactly, like you can't compare.
And I mean, I've shared some of the things that made me laugh quite a bit watching the episodes, but can you share one of the things that made you laugh whilst you're preparing like some of the sketches?
Oh man, I think a lot of the things that make me laugh, that scene that you're referencing with Sage in the latest video about the Boston Marathon, that took us so long to film because we were just cracking up. It was just way too funny. Yeah, I mean, so I don't have a lot of experience being in front of the camera. Yeah. So my background's in corporate video. And for years, I worked in an investment bank, essentially turning PowerPoint slides into videos. I guess that makes them more interesting. So being in front of the camera is really new for me. So, you know, whether it's funny or just like having to act or something, it's been quite a challenge to be the main character in these videos. And it's definitely something that's taken me out of my comfort zone. And, you know, when I initially started, I was thinking like, can I film somebody else doing them? But like, I mean, it's hard to convince people to do this, right? So, yeah, it's been a challenge. I try not to laugh when I'm filming it because I think delivering the lines as deadpan as possible really helps. Definitely the hardest shoot was the training in winter video because it was 2 feet of snow on the ground that day and actively snowing. And I was wearing the Tracksmith shorts and singlet that day. And I was freezing. Like, my jaw was so cold, I was having trouble reading the lines. And I think you can hear it a little bit in the video. Like, it sounds like I'm slurring my lines. And, like, it's not because I've been drinking or anything. It's because, like, my face is frozen.
I think you did quite a good job there. I mean, you did do quite a good David Goggins. I mean, you were looking like it wasn't fazing you at all.
You know what it is? Like that outfit, like, I kind of think of the character like a cartoon character. where, like, no matter where he is, he's got to look exactly the same, whether it's in the snow or sitting in the hot tub or, like, sitting in bed.
It's going to be no deviation. I know what you mean. That's a super outfit, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But then that leads to things like freezing, absolutely freezing in the dead of winter trying to shoot a video.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just want to sort of go back to what you were talking about before, about your role, your previous role in terms of sort of video production, working in investment bank, and obviously being behind the camera. And can you sort of share some of the skills that you've learned from that role into what you're doing now? And obviously you touch upon what you said about, you know, moving outside your comfort zone and being in front of the camera.
Yeah. So, I mean, like the industry in general is changing. So I think a lot of things are happening, right? I think video production, you know, if you're not like in the motion picture or like Netflix tier or things, like basically everything else, the equipment is becoming, and even the people who operate equipment to some extent are becoming very commoditized, right? Like, so you can't really hold a place in the market as a videographer just because you've invested money in the equipment, because I mean, everybody's iPhone takes pretty damn good video these days, yeah. Right? So to stay relevant in like the video industry and the way social media and YouTube are changing things, like it's much more important to have good content, even if it's not technically as good, right? From like the camera spec. Well, audio is the only thing. People will forgive bad video much more than they'll forgive bad audio. Yeah. But, you know, it really makes it an interesting challenge to figure out, like, okay, like I can't just shoot pretty pictures because everybody can do that now, right? How do I make content that says something or resonates with an audience, or, you know, is effective in making the viewer do some particular action? And I think that YouTube and social media at the same time have, I don't want to say lowered the standard, but changed the standards, right? Where, you know, it's not so much, you know, getting other people in front of the camera, but putting yourself out there, right? And so, you know, you are the cameraman, you are the sound the boom operator, you are the editor, and you know what? You're also the talent. And, you know, part of me feels like this is horrifying, right? Like, oh, the whole industry is being turned upside down, but it just creates new challenges, right? And like, you know, thinking in terms of, you know, how do I make a 15-second TikTok video that works, right? Or, you know, how do I film this thing when I don't have a camera operator because I'm pointing the camera at myself? So new challenges, which are always fun to tackle. And like I said, personally, me being in front of the camera is, I'm extremely uncomfortable doing it. I've gotten a lot better at it. But I guess that's the way we grow, right? Like putting ourselves into uncomfortable situations.
Yeah, I agree with that, because that's one of the reasons why I actually started my podcast, because I didn't really like, I guess, the sound of my phone voice, I guess, and then you always hear it in your own mind, then you hear your voice, it sounds worse than it actually is. Then you do a couple of podcasts, mm-hmm. You're just like, oh, no one's died, keep going on. And I guess it's the same thing after you've done the video a couple of times. You're like, actually, I'm you know, a little less, I guess I'm further forward than I was before.
Yeah, I mean, the first couple were terrifying, and, you know, all those thoughts about, like, is this going to be an embarrassment? Like, is everybody going to be like, oh my God, like, what is he doing? You know, if I apply for a job in 5 years, are they going to find this and be like, oh wow, this guy, like, we can't hire him. Right? Yeah. Like, all these crazy thoughts go through your head. But to your point, you're right, you do it, and, like, you know, like, honestly, like you care and you're more nervous about it than anybody else.
Yeah. I think I can totally relate to kind of what you're saying. And something I was sort of thinking about as well is when you talked about from the corporate world and then sort of moving those skills onto this kind of the online element. And I guess the challenge that you probably find, and so many other people find as well, is getting the balance right between you're producing this content, which, you know, you put on social media, which is essentially goes out for free. Well, until you build up enough of a following, I'd say on YouTube, where you start getting ads paid or get sponsorships or whatever. But I mean, how do you kind of like balance that as well between, you know, doing the work, but making, you know, the free element to getting paid? It must be quite challenging, especially in that industry.
It is. And to be honest, I think you just have to genuinely love it, right? To be willing to invest the time and the effort without any sort of compensation. Because if you go into YouTube thinking like, I'm going to like somehow hack the algorithm and like make videos that are going to get monetized right away and have this huge business model, I mean, I just don't know that it's going to work. I think people would see through that, yeah. Right? Because, but if like for me, you know, I have a day job, but I do the videos, and honestly, they've been more successful than I thought they've been. So, you know, if they generate money, that's a you know, great bonus. But I just love making them. Like, they're fun. And like for years I was bored making corporate videos. And I mean, the best part of this project for me personally is being able to make videos and content that I care about and that I can get excited about. It's really hard to get excited about like a PowerPoint deck for an ETF, right? So I think, you know, I think you have to be passionate enough to kind of put in that effort, and then maybe, you know, and then things will come. Like I've started to get messages, you know, from different companies asking me to like do product review videos, right? And things like this. So like things are working, there's traction happening. These videos have been really good practice for another project that we've got going, doing some media for trail running events. So, you know, if Serious Runner never really makes me a ton of money, like that's okay, right? Because just having that passion and putting something out there in the world is starting to open up other doors. And, you know, I just don't know if you lack that passion, you're going to be able to take that risk.
I think, yeah, there's so many great points in there. And it's sometimes when you're doing these things, it's, you know, it's scary, but there is a fun element of doing it. And, you know, as much as we'd like to be like, yeah, this is the payday and if that's your focus, it's definitely people are going to see through it. Because especially if you're doing videos, I mean, you've done like parodies as well, like subscribe, like, follow, and it's just like, it's too obvious, you know. It's like, okay, stop, just relax, just give me something that I'm, you know, people have got a lot on their day, so they kind of don't really want to hear that. They kind of know the script.
Yeah, and it's so noisy too, YouTube. Like when I started, so Serious Runner was not the first video series I put out. I started making YouTube videos, like I said, because I was bored with the corporate stuff, right? But a big challenge was I just didn't want to do what everybody else was doing. And I think that, you know, finding something unique and like a unique voice in the form of Serious Runner has allowed it to be something that's got some momentum.
I think that's really cool to see. And like you said, it's just one of those things that naturally evolve. And I'm sort of thinking, have you had any kind of backlash to the character from Serious Runners out there that can't see it, or brands at all?
No, not yet. I mean, I've gotten a couple of thumbs down on the videos on YouTube, but I have not received any messages or anything with specific like criticisms or anything like that.
That's a good thing, to be honest. It'd probably be for me going, I can't believe you accurately portrayed me in my Strava thing, or how I recover on easy days. So stop showing the world these things. You're letting everyone into the secrets.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the comments are like, oh, like I'm guilty of this, ha ha ha, yeah. But nothing like I'm like
offended.
So far, nobody seems offended or like insulted by it. Sometimes around here on the trails, if I'm like running up a trail or something and getting winded, you know, every now and again, somebody will call out to me like, "Oh, come on! I thought you were a serious runner." So, locally, I get teased about it a little bit, but nothing malicious. No.
But are you dressed in the serious runner outfit though? Like, the cap, tracksuit, attire.
No.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I guess you've got to wear a different singlet.
Well, yeah, and it's funny, and like what happened the other day, there was a Hoka group run here in Boulder for their new trail shoe, the Zanal.
Yep.
And I showed up to that, and some kid comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, are you the serious runner?" And I was like, "Yeah, but not today." Like, I'm just here to have fun and run some trails. Like, I'm not, like that's not who I am, really. But it's fun. People, like I said, it's all in jest and stuff, so it's great.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's a great response back as well, because when people go, "Is it you?" You go, "Yes, I am." It's always a weird moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, I am. I am a serious runner. I love that, not today. Yeah. I think it's the best way to respond back to it. And I'm sort of thinking, what question would the serious runner ask himself if he was being interviewed for a running podcast?
If the character was being interviewed, what would you ask him?
Yeah, what would he ask? What would he want to ask himself?
Oh man, I think a serious runner defines himself by running and his accomplishments and sees that as his place in the world. Oh man, this is a tough question. I think it would be something along the lines of, I don't know. I think what I would love to ask a serious runner is does all this stuff make him happy? I don't know that I have a good answer to this question.
I think it's a good question though, to ask as a runner yourself, like, do these things make you happy? And I think sometimes I do ask myself that question when I see like my goals or other people setting goals. Does it lead you to being the truer version of yourself, whatever that is, or is it leading you into someone else's definition of what a runner or success looks like?
Yeah, and what are you getting out of running, right? Like,
yeah.
Like if I run a 2:55 instead of a 2:45, like, does that materially change my life? But if running brings me community and friends, right? Like, who cares what pace I'm running?
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I know we've given a lot of focus to the serious runner character, but I wanted to go into one final thing before we kind of wrap this up. Is talk about your running and your running goals. I mean, what sort of things are you looking forward to in the next 12 months or so? What are you planning to do?
Yeah, so right now I am trying to get over an injury. My goal race is the California International Marathon in early December, which I think I am going to shoot for a 2:45 at. Along the way, I'm going to run Boston, but I'm not really trained to PR Boston, so Boston is going to just be a bit of fun. I think I'm going to run it in costume as serious runner.
Oh my gosh, that'd be brilliant.
So there'll be some content like serious runner at the Boston Expo or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking about it, and this is a challenging thing. I'm thinking about running all of Boston in character with the GoPro.
Yeah.
But running with a GoPro is something a serious runner would never do. So, but you know, like, I'm not sure how else to make a serious runner runs Boston video, and I feel like that has to happen.
Unless you get Sage to like just decide to be a wingman and just like reduce his paces seriously to do that, could be an option.
Yeah, I should ask him about that. But but yeah, Boston, CIM, looking at Bandera 100K, which is a trail ultra in Texas in January just to get some Western States lotto tickets. And then I'm in the 50K in UTMB next summer.
Awesome. So what is it about the trail races that kind of interests you as well between the roads and the trails?
So not having any sort of running background or pedigree, like qualifying for Boston for me personally was extremely difficult. And it took me like 3 or 4 years to get there. And to me in road running, like we discussed before, right? Like the BQ is the finish line a lot of times, right?
Yeah.
But I also know that, I might be able to get my PR down into 5 or 10 minutes or something. But I felt that there wasn't much more that I could accomplish in road running, right? I'll just never be good enough to get to the trials, right? Like 200 people every 4 years, 200 men every 4 years make the Olympic trials in the U.S. Like I'm not getting down to a 219. You know, once I had gotten Boston done, it was sort of like, well, what's the next challenge?
Yeah.
And that led me to trails, you know, like, oh, you know, I'll try an ultra, I'll try 100, and you know, see what I can do there.
Okay. Kind of makes sense. So, sort of thinking back to your question about with the series, when everybody asks himself, is he happy? And a question that I would ask to you as well, and even myself, would be, but obviously to you, because obviously it can't be a one-man monologue and you're just listening, because that'd just be weird. But the question would be, like, obviously, once you qualified for Boston and you achieved it and you did all those things, what did you reflect on? I mean, did it make you happy? I mean,
it made me happy because it proved to myself that I could set a really ambitious goal, work hard, and achieve it. And I had been personally in a point in my life where, like, I was just so unfulfilled professionally with what I was doing from a career standpoint. And I think that the 4-year journey of starting running and getting into running Boston just provided me some, like, much needed, like, confirmation that I can set my sights on hard things. And get there.
I hear you, because it sort of shakes you up and makes you think, oh, actually, I can do these things.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, why don't I try something else? Yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of like the same thing with the YouTube stuff. Like, I kind of want to make videos that I care about and put them out there, but, you know, am I going to embarrass myself? Are people going to even like them? You know, like, what's the reaction going to be? And like the success that I'm seeing there, like it's great. And I think for me personally, running at this point, running for me personally is not really the goal itself, right? Like it's not about the running. It's about these other things, right? Like being able to channel my creativity into something that's meaningful to me. Or to build relationships and friendships, right? Or, you know, to roll it into other sort of projects, like the trail running coverage project. And, like, all that's related to running.
Yeah.
But, like, that stuff is stuff I'm going to explore regardless of how fast I can run a marathon.
Yeah, you obviously do the stuff yourself, but then you realize, obviously, community... leaving an impact, leaving it in a better place than you came into it before, passing it forward to other people. I think that's such an important part of running, because otherwise everyone could do it in small ways. It doesn't have to be massive ways, but I guess if there's something that you can do to help inspire someone else or make it better for someone else coming into the sport, no matter how small, I think that is so important.
Yeah. So maybe that's the question for Serious Runner. Like for all the posturing that you're doing on Strava and social media to make yourself look like this great, big, important runner, like how is running benefiting you in your life, and how are you using it in a positive way for yourself or for others?
Do you know what? I think that's a great question. I think even for listeners to probably reflect on, not in a patronizing way, and even for myself to think about as well afterwards, post this conversation. These are the sort of questions I think we need to always be thinking about as well. Because like the running community, you know, we're just custodians of the sport at the end of the day. We're not, it's not ours. It's not fixed. It's changing.
Absolutely.
You know, Stephen, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. How can people follow you online and follow your work?
Yeah. So right now, you search either Serious Runner or my name, Stephen Ganoza, on YouTube to find the Serious Runner YouTube videos on my YouTube channel. It's still my personal YouTube channel. Something I've gone back and forth on is, you know, do I only make Serious Runner content or do I keep the channel open for different sort of series? I kind of want to keep it open for different kind of series. So you'll find that under my name. But I have made dedicated Serious Runner Instagram and Twitter accounts that you can find and follow, which I try to post fun things there. And then personally, I'm across social media, just at Stephen Ganoza.
Actually, one thing before we wrap this up, and yeah, it kind of ties into the beginning of what you spoke about, wanting to make a documentary, then sort of falling into making this kind of reflection of what you were doing, what we were all doing as runners, highlighting those things. Have you got any sort of thoughts about moving into a documentary or something kind of a little bit more, I guess, more serious, I guess. And I couldn't find the right word to it.
Yeah. Serious. Serious has become a loaded word now, hasn't it?
It has, yeah.
So yes, and I'll briefly touch on the trail running project, and you know, maybe we'll find an opportunity to discuss that into detail much at a later time. But one thing that's come out of this is myself, Sage, and Matt Daniels, another professional runner for Nike, have started a company called Mutt Running, Mountain Ultra Trail Running. And as part of that, we're trying to create more media, mostly around sub-ultra trail distance races, just because like the 100 milers and the 200 milers get all the glory, but like there are trail half marathons. So as part of that, we've been putting together different videos. And if you search Mutt Running on YouTube, you'll find one about Ryan Smith, who's actually a friend of ours here in Boulder, who runs the local trail running group that we belong to, Rocky Mountain Runners. He finished third place at the Hard Rock 100 last month. And that was our first foray into something that's much more like trail documentary. And it, I mean, it was exhausting because we essentially had to film the whole, you know, 30 something hour race or something. But it was a lot of fun. And I think that would be a really interesting format to explore, with the caveat that there are a lot of trail docs out there already, right? Yeah. Like, you know, there's Ginger Runner and Billy Yang, and like people are doing this sort of thing. So one of the things I'm currently exploring is like, how do we do trail docs, but with a unique lens, right? And yeah, maybe that's the shorter distances. Maybe it's something else. I'm not sure, but you know, that is something that I would love to do more of.
And it's funny how it's come about really from the work you're doing, and like failing, trying something. And it goes to show like where you start may not be the place that you finish, but the things that you learn along the way add to where you're going.
Yeah. I mean, like just trying to make videos for YouTube is a whole different game than corporate videos. I mean, corporate videos, you have a captive audience. They're sitting in an auditorium or a boardroom or something, and they have to watch your like 3 to 5 minute presentation video. YouTube, people could click off at any moment. So it's a different game for sure. And yeah, like I said, all of it's been a challenge. It's been fun. And I'm just really grateful for the opportunities that I've had to be able to put the time and effort, and to have the friends like Sage to, you know, back me up and help me with these projects.
Yeah, I mean, it's, what you're doing is great, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it leads to next. And Stephen, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and thank you for being a guest on the Runner's Life podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Marcus.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Runner's Life. If you found value in this episode, and you want to support the show, please share with your community, post on your social media channels, and encourage them to listen and subscribe. If you want to support my work directly, you can become a member on Patreon at www.patreon.com/arunnerslife. If you want to get updates on the podcast, or you want to see what I'm up to, you can follow me on Instagram at arunnerslife_podcast and at TheMarathonMarcus. Your time is valuable, so thank you for spending your time listening to this episode of A Runner's Life podcast.